This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Eco Radio. On today's show, Richard Mabian will host Eric Kirkendall of the newly emerging MOCAN Clean Air Coalition, a group that focuses on keeping the air you breathe healthy. Also joining us today is John Kerman. He'll be updating us on the Keystone XL pipeline developments. But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I have your news. StLouisToday.com reports, Nebraska's highest court threw out a challenge Friday to a proposed route for the Keystone XL oil pipeline, even though a majority of judges agreed the landowners who sued should have won their case. The decision removes a major roadblock for the $8 billion cross-continental project that Republicans avowed to make a key part of their 2015 agenda in Congress. Four judges on the seven-member Nebraska Supreme Court said the landowners should have won the case. Their lawsuit challenged a 2012 state law that allowed the governor to empower Canada-based TransCanada to force them to sell their property for the project. ThinkProgress.org reports, the House of Representatives has voted 266 to 153 to pass legislation approving the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, marking the 10th time the lower house has okayed construction of the controversial project. Friday's vote precedes an upcoming Senate vote, which will also likely approve the controversial pipeline, eventually sending the bill to President Obama's desk. The White House has already stated that Obama would veto the legislation. The vote also comes just hours after Nebraska's highest court effectively confirmed that the 1,700-mile pipeline has a legal route through the state, though the court left it open for the route to be challenged in court again. With both chambers of the new Congress now controlled by Republicans, passing Keystone XL has become a priority. Indeed, Republican leaders have confirmed that it will be the first legislation sent to President Obama's desk in 2015. WashingtonPost.com reports, New York City announced Thursday that as of this summer, those plastic foam containers, cups, plates, and the like are going to be banned. This is not going to happen overnight, of course, because there are a lot of these containers made of plastic resin known as expanded polystyrene floating around New York. The city collected about 28,500 tons of expanded polystyrene last year. About 90% of that was from food cups, containers, and the like. In other words, that's roughly one ton of these cups and containers for every 327 residents. The New York City Council passed a law in December 2013, during the final weeks of Mayor Michael Bloomberg's time in office, banning these containers. This move brings New York, the country's biggest city, in line with dozens of other cities that have enacted similar bans for being environmentally unsound. Vendors in San Francisco are banned from preparing or serving food using such containers. Minneapolis banned the containers last year. Seattle banned these foam containers in 2009. And if a restaurant in the city uses one of these containers, they could be fined up to $250. They will also be banned next year in the District of Columbia under a law signed by then-D.C. Mayor Vincent C. Gray. I'd like to turn the mic over to Mr. Richard Mabian.
Thank you there, naturally. I appreciate you. And hello, everyone. Happy New Year's. This is going to be quite a year. In fact, if I'm knowing truth about it, it's going to be the next 2 years are going to be very interesting, just about in every nook and cranny in this country. And most of it is going to be finding its foundation in the political arena. That's why we have John Kerman in here with us today. John, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
To kick this show off, because I think this Keystone Pipeline circumstance is a prime example of what this country is about to experience. It's going to become a even more devastating left-right Democrat, Republican, whichever one of those categories, liberal, conservative, that you want to put it in, we're getting ready to head in that direction.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to have Eco Radio, because we're going to be the one that's going to bring it to you and make sure you're hearing it from the perspective that is the truth, at least the truth that we know it. And what we're going to do is, like we're doing today with John, anytime we have an incident like what's going on with the Keystone pipeline, we're going to bring a person who has that as a passion behind it, has really worked it and studied it. So, John, first of all, explain to us what happened in Nebraska.
All right. So there hadn't been much of anything happening with the Keystone pipeline since last spring. The State Department had released the final supplemental environmental impact statement on it at the end of January, which opened a 30-day public comment period and a 90-day comment period for other federal agencies. And just about the time we thought that, just about the time that was over, this whole thing happened with this lawsuit in Nebraska where these landowners sued over the process by which the route, a revised route, was approved in Nebraska. And they won in a lower court ruling. And so the Obama administration announced we're putting this thing, the State Department application process, on hold until things are resolved in the Nebraska Supreme Court, which this ruling was appealed to. Now, there was also a lot of speculation that they didn't want to make a decision on Keystone XL prior to the November elections, thinking whichever way they went on it, it was going to hurt some Democrats in the election. And maybe that's true, maybe that's not, but the Democrats got hurt plenty bad as it is. So yeah, maybe they should have taken a strong stand against Keystone XL and for climate action, and maybe the base would have been a little happier with them and would have showed up at the polls. Anyway, I won't go on about that anymore. So what happened on Friday is that the Supreme Court issued its ruling in the case. And as naturally said in the news, a majority of the Nebraska Supreme Court ruled in favor of the landowners that the process by which the route was approved was unconstitutional. But under Nebraska law, you don't just need a majority. You need a supermajority to overturn legislation. And they didn't have it. They had 4 out of 7 instead of 5 out of 7 votes. The really interesting thing I read over the weekend, though, is that the three judges who didn't vote that it was unconstitutional, they didn't vote that it was constitutional. They just didn't vote, which I thought, that's a mighty strange thing to happen. How do you sit out a vote unless you have a conflict of interest? Of course, you're supposed to recuse yourself if you have a conflict of interest. Anyway, whatever the case, the landowners did not succeed in their suit now. Now, because of the way the ruling came down with this 4-3 vote, they are considering further legal action. But what this does is, for better or worse, and I think it's for better, it ends this sort of limbo that we've been in. Now the State Department process can get restarted. We can move forward on the State Department ruling whether Keystone XL is in the national interest, because they have to rule it's in the national interest in order for it to be built, because it's a cross-border infrastructure project. That's why the State Department has jurisdiction over this thing, because it crosses the Canada-U.S. border. And this puts it squarely back on President Obama's desk, where we want it. Because, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, what I want to do, because I know we got time, don't worry about that. We got people that I know that are new. In fact, I have a group of folks from VA hospital today who were in the medical section where I got my colonoscopy that I told you I would give you a shout out tonight when I was on the air. So if you're listening, what's going on, gang, that may not understand what the Keystone pipeline is about. So explain how that's supposed to work.
So the Keystone XL pipeline is a pipeline proposed by the TransCanada Corporation, which is a Canadian corporation. That's a really important part of this, that would run from Hardisty in Alberta, Canada, all the way to the Texas Gulf Coast. Now, a good chunk of it is already built and in service, but the section that would run from Hardisty to Steel City, Nebraska, the section that would actually cross the Canada-U.S. border, is not built because they have never gotten the approval. Their application, TransCanada's application, has never gotten the approval of the State Department for this cross-border infrastructure. And that's because we've been going through this long, drawn-out process. When this thing was first proposed, every oil and gas industry insider said this will be rubber-stamped because that's the way these cross-border pipelines and other infrastructure typically are handled. But because the 350.org International Grassroots Climate Action Movement looked at this thing and said, this is a fight worth picking. This is a fight worth standing. And they did that because James Hansen, who's probably the most renowned climatologist in the world, said if we fully exploit the tar sands to produce oil, it will be game over for the climate, essentially. And so we decided we needed to make a stand on this because the tar sands need to stay in the ground, as much of them as possible, and also because it is President Obama's decision alone. He doesn't need Congress to turn Keystone XL down. And he's talked a great game on climate.
Right.
He's said a lot of things. And he's done some good things. But this is one more thing he needs to do.
Okay. Before we tell you why you're here to announce what's happening tomorrow, mm-hmm. explain what the Republican-controlled Congress is trying to do.
Yeah. As naturally said in the news, the House, which has been controlled for the past 2 years, is it, by the Republicans, have passed approval of the Keystone XL pipeline 9 times, and now in the new Congress, the House has voted for it again. They've tried to get it through the Senate, but during the previous Congress, which the Democrats were in control of the Senate, they fell one vote short. They had 59 votes in favor of approving Keystone XL. And in the Senate, because of the rules, you got to have 60 votes, supermajority, in order to pass anything of consequence, basically. So they fell one vote short. But, of course, the election happened in November, and the Republicans now control Congress, or control the Senate, as well as the House. They have 54 seats. 9 of the Democrats who voted for Keystone XL in November kept their seats, and we fully expect, including our own Senator Claire McCaskill here in Missouri, kept their seats, and we expect them to vote for this new Keystone XL bill when it comes up. That means they have 63 votes in favor, which is enough to pass the bill, but not enough to overcome a presidential veto. And they also don't have enough votes in the House to overcome a presidential veto. So President Obama has announced that he will veto this legislation. So we don't have to worry about that becoming law. That seems pretty safe. But what we want is for President Obama to put an end to this and just push the State Department to release the national interest determination saying that it is not in the national interest to build Keystone XL, and the application is rejected.
All right, so tomorrow we are doing what?
Tomorrow we are having a rally, which is part of a series of rallies all the way across the country. We expect there to be one in all 50 states. I think 160-some have already been organized, last I heard, and more being organized. And those rallies are to do just that, to call on President Obama to reject the Keystone XL pipeline now. Don't wait for the Senate to vote. Don't wait for the legislation to show up on your desk. Reject it right now. And he has the power to do that. That doesn't mean Congress can't still pass legislation. They can.
Right.
But he can veto that. Now, here's where things are going to get tricky for us. We know after this legislation is vetoed by President Obama that the Republicans are going to start attaching it to other legislation.
Right.
And they're going to attach it to other legislation that, one, Obama needs or really wants. So where it's going to get tricky is when they attach it to, say, funding for one department or another. The next one of those that comes up is Department of Homeland Security, which in the last appropriations bill was only funded through the end of February. And then there's debt ceiling limits. So that's where it's going to get tricky. We'll see how stiff Obama's spine is when they stick this thing. He's stood firm in recent showdowns with Congress. But I don't know.
Okay,
that's why we need to be behind him and saying, stand firm.
Okay, what I need to hear from you is the place and the time,
yep.
And then we will repeat it again before we leave this, mm-hmm. the air.
Great. So yeah, real quick, 7 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday evening, at the J.C. Nichols Fountain, Mill Creek Park, Emmanuel Cleaver 2 Boulevard, and J.C. Nichols Parkway. Most everybody's probably familiar with that fountain there.
Yeah,
it's commonly
yeah.
called the Horsey Fountain.
Right.
It's going to be at 7 p.m. We're not going to stay out there very long because it is going to be chilly, but we ask you, please, layer up, come on out, and hang out with us for at least a half an hour so we're part of this national, maybe international event, and hopefully so when the media, if we can get the media, thankfully KKFI covers these things, but it's tough to get the rest of the media. Hopefully the media will come out and they'll see a good, strong crowd out there and we'll get some coverage.
Okay. Appreciate you coming in.
Thank
I know
you, Richard.
We're running out of here real quick. I got a break coming up, but I wanted to be able to make sure they heard some background on why we're doing it and the time that we're going to be there tomorrow is 7 p.m. at the J.C. Nichols Fountain.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thank
hang
you, Richard.
There. You fought this case all the way, so hang in there.
All right. Thanks. We're almost to the end.
All right, guys, we're going to take a break here on you. Be right back.
This week, holistic health guru Deepak Chopra explains how to believe in God in a secular, skeptical age.
I think if you're not totally bowled over by the fact that you exist and that you are also aware of your existence, if you're not perpetually surprised, your humanity is incomplete.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before the Jazz Disciple.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
All righty, I'm back again, and I hope y'all heard that, and we repeat it again before we get off the air, but we're having that rally tomorrow at 7 p.m. at J.C. Nichols Fine. And anyone can get there. Come on out. You know where it is. You know what we do. And I'm just glad that we have people here like John Kerman here in Kansas City that are willing to represent that for us and make sure we stay up to date on what's going on. Now, before while I was in the process of doing that, I told you about my shout out to my new listeners out there and that I met today at the VA. So if any of you are listening, and if you're not, that's okay. To the rest of you who always listen to my show, we're going to have the line open again tonight. We're opening it up now so you can call in 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. The reason I want it open now is because we're getting ready to have a discussion about a new organization that's getting ready to form here in the Kansas City metropolitan area. And that's what Eric Kirkendall is here to explain and tell us all about it. So, Eric, first of all, introduce yourself, let people know what you do, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you, Richard. I'm Eric Kirkendall, director of the Diesel Health Project, with which Richard helped form. And we and the Diesel Health Project, Sierra Club, KU Environmental Studies Program, Children's Mercy Hospital Environmental Center, Sierra Club, and other groups are working together to form a clean air coalition in the Kansas City region.
Okay. A clean air coalition.
Yes, indeed.
Explain that a little bit more. What does that mean?
Well, in a lot of cities that have been at this longer than we have, there's a umbrella group that represents everybody, all the health organizations, community groups, etc., and watches out to keep the air clean. In Kansas City, we're facing huge increases in diesel truck traffic and train traffic over the next few years. Imports are climbing. Kansas City's a big center. So we're pulling together as a coalition of organizations to have a seat at the table, to work with community groups, empower them, train them, monitor, just like we have been for Diesel Health Project, et cetera.
Okay, now Eric's been here before. Those of you who are regular listeners, so you know you've heard the conversation about the increase in truck traffic and the increase in diesel emissions that's going on in the greater Kansas City metropolitan area because of that new hub that our guy up north, Buffett, with his Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, helped put in out there in Edgerton. You folks living out there in Johnson County, I know that you really don't pay a whole lot of attention to that project that's going on, but in time, that's going to be a major factor in your community, your children, and around, just based on the emissions that's going to be circulating around out there in that community. You want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do. I'd like to tell a little story about that. When BNSF and their development partners were pushing for the idea of building this facility, they were talking about bringing in 1.5 million containers, mostly Asian imports, per year, generating 30,000 new truck trips a day. when it came time, when it turned out that they had to get federal approval, do an environmental study, and get Corps of Engineer approval, that number changed to 870 to 880,000, maybe three quarters, 60-some percent of it. The day it opened, that number went back to 1.5 million. So that's a lot of trucks.
A lot of trucks. That is the key issue that's there. I met yesterday with the Kansas Sierra Club group in a home in Lenexa. And I started realizing how those areas, well, this is right off of 435, not too far from there. And that's going to be a key area for that truck traffic going to Edgerton back and forth and through and around there. So this it will become more and more of an issue for the suburbs, so to speak, which now you don't. We've been focusing most of our attention into the inner cities around our industrial plants and the whole bit. The reason I'm making that statement is because now it's going to require all of us coming together in a collaborative type of way to be able to monitor the air that's involved in the greater Kansas City metropolitan area for all of us. Okay, so you start naming off. That's what this alliance is designed to create, right?
It sure is. One of the big things that's happening that very few people understand is that railroads are moving, BNSF certainly, and some of the other railroads too, are moving from a business model where they take imports directly to their destination city, like to Oklahoma City, to a hub-and-spoke system. And in the hub-and-spoke system, they take them just so far by train, then they put them on trucks, take them the next up to 500 miles. The reason they're doing that is the systems are clogged. There's so many imports coming in Los Angeles and Long Beach. Kansas City has the misfortune to be a hub where the goods are transferred from rail to truck. So what's going to happen is those trucks are going to radiate out all points of the compass throughout the metro area, go northeast, south, west, out of Kansas City, on every highway through all kinds of neighborhoods. So the health issues that have formerly been visited just on poor neighborhoods, say, bordering the intermodal rail yard in Kansas City, Kansas, right, are going to now be visited on other neighborhoods. And diesel exhaust, as you mentioned, Richard, is extremely dangerous. You do not want to live within 500 yards of a major freight route or a rail yard, especially if you have children.
So that includes your highways and your train tracks, and we are surrounded by that, and especially in Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri. So we're really making you all out there aware of this fact. We want you to know it. Now, this coalition, you were naming some groups that you have reached out. Now, I'm telling you, I ended up attending a session up at KU. With some folks up there who he has gotten interested in being a part of this coalition. Is that correct?
That's true. We've got community groups, members of community groups out of Kansas City, Kansas, right. You, Letitia DeCagney, right, and others. And we're going to be bringing more groups in like that, more health-related organizations, more university folks.
Okay.
Just about anybody who has an interest in clean air and public health.
That's where I'm looking at it, folks, you out there listening, because we need the everyday dog involved on this. We need eyes and ears all over the Kansas City metropolitan area, and this group would be an ideal way for you to get involved. When I think about the weather stations back when I was growing up, they didn't have Mary out in Edgerton and Babaloo over here, but all of a sudden they started developing these networks. And when weather is bad, they have people who are phoning in what's happening in my neighborhood. It's giving the weather broadcasters instant knowledge of what's going on in these different little small areas around the Kansas City metropolitan area. And we need to do that on this clean air. And that's what this group is going to be able to do. Is there a group like this formed anywhere else?
There sure is. Houston has the Houston Air Alliance. Los Angeles has a good group. There's quite a few of them around the country.
So most of them have formed where you had ports, Is that it?
That's true.
See, now I want to make sure we're explaining to folks, because sometimes, you know, we talk about things in ways that we know, but others really don't understand. Mm-hmm. Kansas City, this hub you're talking about, is becoming the largest inland port. Is that correct?
BNSF and their marketing presentations have said it will be one of the biggest in the world.
Biggest in the world. Not just United States.
Yeah.
The biggest in the world. You know, we make that comment about an additional 30,000 trucks a day as if that's nothing. 30,000 trucks a day is a lot of trucks. That's a lot of truck traffic to be going through the greater Kansas City metropolitan area.
It's a lot of congestion.
It's
dangerous. It's expensive.
Oh.
Somebody's going to have to pay to expand those highways.
Yeah, there's wear and tear on your your highways. This is the potential for the accidents that go on when you have those trucks involved in it. But then you come back to the diesel emissions that creates the carcinogen that is cancer related, and so that's a lot.
Can I share some recent news on that? You hit the cancer issue. Diesel has been named diesel emissions has been named a carcinogen by World Health Organization, well known, and the state of California as well. EPA says it's a suspected carcinogen. They haven't quite gotten the U.S. government hasn't quite gotten there, but they will. Last year, Harvard University did a huge study that said a good part of the cause of autism is particulate matter from diesel emissions.
That's unreal.
Diabetes, low birth weight rate, delayed development of lungs, all kinds of problems come from diesel emissions. The bad health news is coming out almost every week.
You know, my reason for getting into this environmental movement from the jump was because I started hearing and discovering things that I knew nothing about. And I realized, me, who's actively involved in life and engaged in these various circumstances, know nothing about it. What about people who are just your everyday folks? Just, you know, I get up, send my kids to school, I go to work, and, you know, I come home in the evening, and we have dinner, and we sit around the house and watch TV and stuff. Kids go outside and play with the dog. Then we come in and go to bed. They are totally clueless of what is going on in this country from our corporate world as far as their money-making ventures are concerned, the results of which becomes a factor in the everyday person's life.
There's a lot of money to be made if you can move something or produce something and make somebody else pay part of the costs by subjecting them to the pollution from that. And that's called an externality in economics, and that's a lot of what this is about. Railroad makes the money. They make billions of dollars a year. Regular people pay for it in terms of health, especially groups that are in disadvantaged neighborhoods that don't have the political clout to keep those kind of facilities out. The key, step one for us, is education. If people understand the personal risks of diesel emissions, there is a lot they individually can do to avoid exposure. They can change their routes to work. They can shut the windows of their car when they're in an area they shouldn't be in. They can turn the blower off on their car to stop the diesel emissions from coming in. There are individual things people can do. But more importantly, they can team together. The way to solve this is through politics and through people working with each other and helping learn and empower their own themselves, their own communities, to fight this and make them safer. There are a lot of really simple decisions that can be made that can make this better. In California, there's groups like this working hard. They've been doing it for a very long time. They've had big wins sometimes just by moving the entrance to a rail yard to get it away from a community. On the other hand, communities can make huge mistakes. I know a city which I believe in the metro area, which I think followed through and located a brand new grade school right next to the main line of the BNSF. They did not have to do that.
Yeah.
So a little bit of education, little better decision making could have saved a lot of people's health.
Well, you know, now that you're saying that, it's making me think that in this environmental move that we've had here in Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas. And again, folks, that number is 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Jump in here if you'd like to. It made me think that when the Sierra Club and I got just formed forces and started teaching energy efficiency over in Wyandotte County, we were able to get invited to neighborhood groups. That's grassroots. That's frontline grassroots work. And what we would do is go in, and I would personally make a presentation about energy efficiency, the pros, the cons, the good, the bad, the ugly. So I'm saying, is that something that your group would be able to do with the that would be available for that kind of those kinds of presentations? Would that be something that you would be looking at?
Absolutely. In fact, we just Friday turned in a grant proposal to EPA to get a little bit of money. A little money goes a long way,
right,
for a project called Building Community Capacity to Protect Air Quality and Environmental Health. We want this to take place in Kansas City, Kansas, where your work and mine and Leticia's and Global Community Monitor has already monitored high and dangerous levels of black carbon from diesel emissions. We want to keep working there. We want to identify the most overburdened neighborhoods by diesel emissions, and we want to start working with those communities to train them, to teach them some of the techniques they can do to protect themselves, to encourage them to join our MOCAN Clean Air Coalition,
okay,
so that together that community group in KCK, the one in Kansas City, Missouri, the one in Lawrence, Kansas, maybe the one in Topeka,
right,
can have some clout and pull up to the table when decisions get made, instead of them being made for them, to have the decisions made with their input and with them involved.
That sounds great. I mean, I just noticed you mentioned that name. I might have been the first time you said today. What's the name of the coalition?
MOCAN Clean Air Coalition.
Yeah, I like that. MOCAN Clean Air Coalition. I was just thinking when you were speaking, will any effort also be made towards reaching corporate businesses?
Yes.
The polluters.
Businesses and decision makers that work for city governments. I had I used to live in Johnson County. I now live in Lawrence. But when I lived in Johnson County, I worked with the county. I worked with the head planner of Johnson County, a good person.
Okay.
He did not know. At that time, this is 2007. I'm taking us back quite a few years. He did not know the risk of diesel exhaust. He did not know the planning techniques. This guy is sharp, but he did not know the planning techniques that are used in other parts of the country to protect people from diesel exhaust. One of them, buffer zones. For example, buffer zones mandated throughout California. If you do not, nobody builds a warehouse next to you in California. They require a large buffer zone with a little bit of education and knowledge. This planner, Dean Palos, great guy, worked in the county to put a buffer zone in place for new warehousing. Johnson County has that now. So that's the sort of thing a group like this can do, help train public officials. There's a lot of people in Kansas City who want to do the right thing. They just haven't dealt with this before,
right,
and we can help a lot there.
Well, and you know, and one of my dilemmas is, who do we teach first? You know, I know it's what comes first, the chicken or the egg, and is it, do we educate the public, and then as a group, we I don't like to use terms like demand necessarily, but then we confront elected officials over. I was in a session last week with the Silverhead legislators over in, mm-hmm, over in Kansas City, Kansas,
oh,
for
yeah,
the state of Kansas. And they were sitting in a room with the elected officials out of Kansas City, Kansas. Your state and your state house and senators were there sitting at the table. And those people were directing their concerns for legislation to their elected officials right there in their face. I thought it was an outstanding meeting. It wasn't a negative meeting. They were expressing things that they thought needed to be addressed for seniors. Example, since I got a second here, the liability, and all you out there listening, you need to hear this too. The liability on cars is something like $25,000, $50,000, $10,000. $25,000 for liability, $50,000 for, you know, whatever it is. But those are the three figures. Well, first of all, when seniors get on a fixed income, they don't have a lot of extra money to spend. So if they involved in an accident where the person didn't have insurance, they are stuck with some expense that they don't have. And their insurance, their liability insurance, doesn't cover, like, the property damage is $10,000. You know, that doesn't even begin to cover some of the costs that you could have from someone. Say a person made a mistake and hit their gas when they thought it was the brake and they drove through the front window of a restaurant.
That's right.
So what this group was wanting to do was raise the price, like, to $100,000, $200,000, you know, $100,000 or something like that, to offset it. And they're trying to work with the legislators to make sure that the insurance companies don't gouge them on premium. Now, the reason I'm saying all that is here we got an issue that's similar where we're trying to educate the public. It would really be sharp if we had this Clean Air Alliance with this, what our neighbor groups and everyone sitting in the room talking to the legislatures about those issues. Mm-hmm. As far as education is concerned, could something like that happen?
It's true. There are a lot of good people out there who want to do the right thing, and we can help them learn what the right thing is.
Okay. And so how would you go about, what would be your attitude for going about handling that?
You asked that chicken and egg question a minute ago. I like that.
Yeah.
I think both things could happen at the same time. The techniques that can, the zoning, the infrastructure, the other kinds of techniques that can be used to protect a community are not rocket science. They're fairly straightforward. They've been done other places. They just haven't been done here.
Okay.
So we can provide, we, MOCAN Clean Air Coalition, can provide a service to the community and to elected officials and to professionals, transportation planners, city planners, engineers, people like that, by providing that kind of information. There's a lot of people, given the right facts, given the right tools, will make better decisions. We can do that at the same time we're teaching and empowering a community to look out for each other.
Well, I don't want to be say I'm throwing a monkey wrench into the process, but we have found that many times our local folks, elected officials, don't have the same motivation or attitudes about, what is, for lack of a better word, the greening of America concepts that's going on. Like, California is green. Their governor on down is green. I mean, like, they're passing these laws about the paper plates and all this kind of stuff. Back here in this part of the country, that's the farthest thing from their mind. You know, we don't even have recycled containers at our public staff. You go through a mall, let me see if you got recycled containers.
I sure don't want to sound foolishly optimistic. I don't believe we're going to turn around all elected officials, but I think the key to doing this kind of work is finding people you can work with, people who do want to do the right thing. Sometimes you only move the ball a foot. Sometimes that's all you have to do is move the ball a foot.
Well,
and sometimes maybe you lose some yardage, but over time you can improve the environment and you can improve public health, and that's what we're about.
Well, you know, and in the way it is with me and this in my conservation work, I realized that when I deal with the here and now generation, conservation is not an issue. So while you're talking to them, they're looking at you like you're nuts. So they'll say things like they told me out there in California, we know it's a problem, but we don't care. You know, I mean, that's kind of the prevailing attitude of your, that's why I refer to them as a here and now generation. But in my particular case, I started realizing, as you're seeing right now, our responsibility becomes to educate a future generation. That's one. Secondly, how to teach people how to do what they can do themselves. We started teaching people energy efficiency about what it is. We couldn't get coal fire plants to shut down a coal fire plant, but yet and still we need to figure out some way to protect the people who live in those communities. So we started finding ways to teach them how to handle things. You know, you mentioned a little bit of it while ago of some of the things you can do to you know, not be outside at certain times, not roll your windows down. I mean, I keep visualizing America with all the polluting kind of circumstances that we have going on in this country, walking around with masks on like they do over in Japan. I keep visualizing us becoming more and more of that kind of nation, using that as a way to try to protect the air, to protect the air that we breathe. And even though that doesn't do very much, it's more symbolic than anything, but still, I see us becoming more and more of a nation that way.
Well, it's ironic. The average air in the average city in America has gotten better in the last 20 years. But for the EJ, environmental justice communities, for the communities that don't have the clout, that live adjacent to these dirty facilities, whether they're a rail yard or a petrochemical plant, their health issues, or a fracking site, their health issues in many cases have gotten worse. So the key at this point, a lot of the average air pollution for the average person living away from a highway and away from a rail yard is getting better. Yeah. It's the people that are stuck next to them that are really suffering.
Okay, well, you know, when you talk in those terms, that's your newfound Lawrence homeland, because you can say you're living away from it, but in the urban areas, we're surrounded by highways. 435 goes completely around the city. So it's kind of difficult to find spaces that are somewhat isolated from potential hurt, harm, and danger, so to speak.
Well, you hit something really important there, too, because another issue is the role of the federal government. For the most part, it's to look out for average air pollution levels. EPA, great organization, has and their counterparts at the state level, they haven't managed monitors in Kansas City. They're looking at particulate matter. But they're on the top of hills, for the most part, in good locations designed to capture averages. We're not talking about averages, as you know.
Right.
We're talking about the kid whose backyard is the rail yard and who's growing up with lung damage because of that, or asthma because of that. So another way that our organization can help is by monitoring hotspots. That's something the government, for the most part, is not doing. It's not the agency's fault. They're told what to do by Congress, and they're funded to do certain work. For the most part, they're not funded to do that work. We can help.
Okay, we're going to stop here and take a break again. And when we come back, Eric, I want us to talk about how anyone listening in can actually become a part of what we're doing. Okay?
Sounds great, Richard.
Is the deluge of money unleashed by recent Supreme Court decisions connected to U.S. failure to address critical issues for building a better future for this country? Linda Vogel Smith, who's the president of the League of Women Voters in Kansas City, will address the effects of money in politics on a range of issues like climate change, voting rights, public education, student debt, and gun control. This Wednesday at noon on the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Who are we, this drug policy reform movement? We're the people who love drugs, we're the people who hate drugs, and we're the people who don't give a damn about drugs. But every one of us believes that the war on drugs is not the way to deal with this stuff.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week, Ethan Nadelman talks about drug policy reform on The Bioneers.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
All right, this is Richard Mabee, and I'm back again. I'm sitting here with Eric Kirkendall, and we're talking about this new clean air alliance called MOCAN Clean Air Alliance that actually I'm working with him on this. I mean, I'm interviewing him about something that I'm working with him on. We talked about that that EJ grant that he was talking about. I'm involved in that too. He's written it up where we're going to be out doing basically the same kind of stuff I have been doing with the Sierra Club.
Can I interrupt, Richard?
Educating people.
None of this would have happened without Richard Mabee.
Come on. Y'all don't need to hear that. But at least I want you to know that I am very much on top of this particular circumstance. And that's why you hear me having so much passion, because I understand that I've been baffled ever since I heard what the increase in truck traffic is going to be. And I think every time I talk to you all, I tell you, when you're out there riding around town sometimes around noon or something, just look up and see if you can catch yourself so totally surrounded by trucks. It happens to me all the time. I just think it's amazing how industry can evade your privacy. And if you didn't have organizations like Eric sitting here who brought this thing to town, we would know nothing about it. Hold tight, we got someone on the air. Caller, you on the air right now. Can you give me your first name and the part of the city you're calling from?
This is Kay in Midtown.
Okay, Kay.
And my question for your guest is, exactly where is this BNSF hub, and what other solutions could be put forward, like retrofits on the exhaust pipes or no idling laws, things like that?
The BNSF Kansas City Intermodal Facility is in Edgerton, great question, in southwest Johnson County. Some remediation was put in place as a result of the environmental assessment and involvement of a lot of folks. There is an air monitor nearby. It's poorly sited. Our group, Diesel Health Project, which Richard is co-founder of, has monitored for diesel exhaust particulate matter out there in order to spot exceedances, in order to spot dangerous conditions. We haven't hit it yet. We haven't seen it yet. Downstream, or what's possible is things like are happening in California, where they are requiring cleaner trucks. Among other things, we'll let that one unfold. We don't know quite what's going to happen yet, except it's going to be a lot of truck traffic.
Yeah, I can jump in here on this too. There's quite a few things that people are doing, Kay, and it's a good question. I'm glad you asked. One, he mentioned the fact that they got trucks to enter into their yard from a different direction. They were entering in through the neighborhood, which was causing that diesel emission to be coming down actually where people's homes were. Two, they were able to find a grant that allowed them to start putting filters on schools and senior high rises to block that air, indoor, outdoor air, the air that was coming into those facilities where those people live. Three, they have started turning more of the equipment that they use at those docks and in those places into extra electric engines and stuff.
I'm talking about L.A.
L.A. That's some of the things they're going to be doing, probably out there in Edgerton, too. Okay, I'm going to have to let this call go. I got about another minute, and we got to clear the line. But thank you for calling in. I appreciate your call. Okay, Eric, you got exactly 30 seconds to tell people how beautiful you are.
I'm not at all. But I do have a phone number. And if anyone's interested in finding out more, getting involved, call me, 785 550 785-550-3408.
Say it again.
785-550-3408. Hey, call if you'd like.
That's right. And that's Eric Kirkendall. You'll see his name on our website if you go look it up. Thank you all for calling in and for listening in and hearing what we're doing. We really appreciate it. We know you're out there, whether you call or not, and we enjoy educating you. Until I'm on again, thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
This is Naturally again, and I have a few events in our local area. Tomorrow, Tuesday, January 13th, there will be rallies across America calling on President Obama to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. In Kansas City, the rally will be hosted at 47th and Main at 7 p.m. Also tomorrow at 6:45 p.m., there will be a Sierra Club general meeting, and it will be about leadership for a sustainable society. Ready to be a leader for a sustainable society? The Northwest Earth Institute offers 10 courses for small groups to collectively move from saying what we believe to doing what we believe. Over 140,000 people have bridged this gap through one of the NWE Institute classes. Find out more about this meeting at the look up Kansas Sierra Club online, or you can call 913-299-4474, and that's tomorrow at 6:45 p.m., and it'll be hosted at the Overland Park Lutheran Church on 79th Street. And on Saturday, January 31st, from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., the Kansas City Urban Farmers 10th Annual Meeting through Cultivate Kansas City. You can come and meet growers and supporters and learn about Cultivate Kansas City's projects over the last year. They'll have pie, coffee, conversation, and learning together as they host this potluck lunch, in addition to the famous pie potluck. Find out more on Cultivate Kansas City's website. And that's all for events today.
Thank you very much, Naturally. We're going to close out now with H2O Radio's This Week in Water, a look at all things happening in the world of water, which is very much a part of our environment. And do stay tuned for Sabor Latino after this ends.
Grow a beard to save water? That and other stories for the week ending January 11th. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
You would think that having safe, clean drinking water would be something that we could all agree on.
After all, the Clean Water Act is one of the most successful pieces of environmental legislation in American history.
But there's a phrase in the law that's been a persistent problem. It's language that compels the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers to, quote, protect the integrity of the waters of the United States.
Defining those waters has been tricky. Some say it means waters you can boat on, while others say it includes creeks, streams, and wetlands. And the plan to refine the definition has opened, well, a deluge of controversy.
One group that's most divided over the proposal? The beer industry. Brewers, it seems, are worried that the new regulations will drive up costs for farmers who grow the grains and hops critical to their beer.
Farmers are worried that the new rules would create additional red tape as more land falls under the agency's oversight. They point to potential restrictions on fertilizer and pesticides as examples.
But not all brewers are piling on. Brewers for Clean Water, a group tied to the Natural Resources Defense Council, backs the new rules, stating that good beer starts with clean water.
As expected, Republicans who have historically tried to rein in the EPA call the new proposed rule a power grab that would define puddles and potholes as navigable waterways.
Senator Mitch McConnell, now the majority leader in the Senate, threw down the gauntlet, saying that stopping the rule would be his highest priority and that he'd do everything he could to push back against the overactive bureaucracy.
EPA's final decision is expected in April. No matter the outcome, it'll probably not likely be the final word on the subject.
China is the world's second biggest economy, and much of the country's water and air is highly polluted. It is estimated that 60% of China's groundwater is too contaminated to drink.
Now the Chinese Supreme People's Court is making it easier for environmental organizations and NGOs to bring lawsuits against polluters. Violators will be required to pay the court costs if they lose.
The new law covers about 700 government-regulated environmental protection groups. These NGOs, which didn't exist before 1994, are highly scrutinized in China and can be closed if they are deemed to be politically inappropriate. Algal blooms happen when wastewater from farms and factories carries nutrients like nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus into rivers, lakes, and seas, and they're a huge problem.
But what if it were possible to use an algal bloom to absorb some of those elements before they run into waterways?
That's the idea behind technology developed by Algal Scientific of Michigan, and they're testing it at the Budweiser Brewery in Idaho Falls.
Brewery effluent is rich in precisely the sorts of organic matter that algae love.
And the process can be conducted in tanks that breweries already use. A report out last week shows that Southern Californians need to do much more to conserve water. A year ago, California Governor Jerry Brown asked all residents to cut water consumption by 20%. Some areas of the state have done that and more.
Others, not so much. Comparing monthly water usage from November 2013 to 2014, statewide consumption was down about 10%. But there were huge regional differences.
In Southern California, from L.A. to San Diego, water use was down by only a bit more than 3%. To the north, in the San Francisco Bay Area, there was an 18% savings, and in Sacramento, 25% savings.
San Diego County still lags in conservation. Water use in the county was overall only down by less than 1%. And in some areas within the county, consumption actually increased by almost 13%.
It is not looking like there will be any relief from the drought in California. The snowpack is currently only 43% of normal, and its reservoirs are only about 40% full.
And speaking of California, the Sacramento Regional Water Authority has found a new villain in the battle against the drought, a razor.
The water agency is inviting residents to skip shaving this winter and show off their drought faces.
According to the utility, growing beards saves water, about 5 gallons per shave. So they want folks to flaunt their whiskers to show their support for conservation.
And it's a contest. A few lucky drought faces will be featured on a digital billboard.
Of course, skipping a shave or two isn't the only way to conserve water. Be Water Smart also suggests shorter showers, turning off the faucet while brushing your teeth, turning off your sprinklers during the winter, and fixing leaks.
To our knowledge, there's no similar contest for women to stop shaving their legs. Yet.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.